There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
On the one hand, you have this massive leg up, but at the same time, there are people who will never read anything that you've written purely because of your route into publishing.
Hello, writers. Welcome back to Write Off, the podcast about writing rejection in all its forms, from self-doubt to books not selling. I'm your host, Francesca Steele, a journalist and writer based in London. And if you want to know more about my own experience with writing rejection, you can hear about that in the first season. Who deserves to be a writer? When Sarah Turner was in her early 20s, she had a baby, found it challenging, and unable to find writing online to match her experience, set up a blog. A couple of years later, that blog, The Unmumsy Mum, had nearly 100,000 readers and landed Sarah a book deal. Her three very funny, honest, non-fiction books about parenting have all been bestsellers, as has her debut novel Stepping Up, which came out this year. So why, you might ask, is Sarah on write-off? Well, because of that question, who deserves to be a writer? Sarah has more than 400,000 followers on Instagram and is famous to many people as an influencer, posting frequently about her three adorable sons, the daily difficulties and the magic of parenting, and their house renovation in Exeter. As such, she knows she's seen by some as someone who has just been handed book deals, someone who maybe can't or shouldn't be allowed to write. The thing is, though, is that Sarah got the book deal because of her blog, because she was already writing stuff that resonated with people. And those books are really well written, including that debut novel. I absolutely love dissecting this question of who deserves their place in publishing with Sarah, who, it should be said, was very aware that some people might be bringing out their tiny violins at this point, and also discussing all the self-doubt that comes with this sort of advantage. Because whatever you think of this sort of route in the end, putting a pen to paper, as it were, and hoping to do a good job is never easy. I really hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Here's Sarah.
I was definitely the kid at school who would write 10 pages for year two English when only one page was required. you know, when I've kept a couple, or my parents kept a couple of my primary school exercise books, and you can see the point at which the teachers have zoned out because they just start putting stickers on everything because it's like she's still going. Yes, always loved writing stories and poems and anything when I was at school. And then in secondary school had a just really massive love of English by the time I got to GCSE year. So it was the subject where I felt like I'd worked really hard at all subjects and always done all right at everything, but never felt like I'd particularly found my thing. And English was the one where I had a teacher who said, you know, can you stay behind and sort of gave me a pep talk and said, you should really do something with this, and kind of gave me that confidence to think, I don't know, I might have something that I might be able to make something with into adulthood. But I didn't really have the courage to pursue it after school. I considered doing English at uni, and I looked at doing a journalism course, and there were all sorts of stuff that I thought about doing. And then I don't know why I bottled it, but I just went, no, I'm going to need to park that. That feels a bit like a pipe dream to be a writer. So I actually did a degree in philosophy instead. And then I went into a fast track finance graduate scheme job, which was completely unrelated to writing. And yeah, quite a random steer.
How interesting that you did something that was kind of almost the polar opposite of what you'd sort of been dreaming of doing. I wonder why that happened, finance as opposed to creative writing.
I know. I didn't have that. Like, I grew up in Cornwall, and I feel like nowadays where you are is, particularly in a kind of post-pandemic world, where you're kind of geographically based has less of a bearing on what you do, because it's kind of like the world has opened up and you can do things online and you can do things over Zoom. But I felt very much, I was a bit of a home bird, and I felt like if I wanted to make something of myself as a writer, I would need to move away and go to London or go somewhere that wasn't Cornwall. As I think that might have played a part. I stuck local. I went to university in Exeter, and that was kind of where my comfort zone. But yeah, I don't know what it was. I didn't ever really dare to dream that I could make it as a writer, even though I thought that I had something there. I thought it would only ever be a hobby, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. And then in your 20s, I'm sorry, I'm not sure exactly how old you were, but you had your son, your first son, Henry.
Yes.
And you started the Unmumsy Mum blog. What was your intention there? How did it come about? And how quickly did you realise that it was doing really well? Because it was.
Yeah. So I had Henry, I think I had Henry quite young. I was 24, and I didn't think that was young at the time, but now I'm like, actually, it was fairly young as first time mums go. And I was working part-time at the University of Exeter at the time, and I'd been kind of thrown into this world of motherhood that just wasn't what I felt like I'd been sold. So I had this, I don't think I had unrealistic expectations about what parenting would be like. My sister had had a baby, my sister-in-law had had a baby. I'd seen the daily reality, but I'd also read and seen a lot of stuff online and in print that presented this kind of glossy version of parenting, like a showreel of the best bits. It was a lot of everybody smiling all the time, a lot of families dressed entirely in white. And and you know, it was the online, it was, that was very much, so we're going back to 2013 here, and it was very much the, in the parenting sphere, it was the hashtag blessed era of parenting online. And it just didn't, I couldn't relate to any of it. And actually I looked online for something that would make me feel better about how I was feeling about parenting, which was that, yeah, there were these moments of absolute magic, but also a lot of the time I felt out of my depth. I felt as though maybe I wasn't doing a good enough job. I felt like I was in part-time work and part-time mothering and not really doing a very good job of either. I was tired, my body didn't feel like my own. And I looked online, I scrolled for something that would make me feel better. And actually everything that I found just made me feel quite a lot worse. Mm. So that was my initial kind of motivation to write something was probably a personal, I need to let this out, almost like a, you know, the blog was the modern day diary, and I felt like I needed to write it down. I hadn't seen any other parenting blogs, but I had seen blogs for kind of food and interiors and things like that at that time. So I just decided to write one, to set one up and write it. And, you know, at that point I had zero social media followers. So I wasn't on Instagram. I didn't have a Facebook page. I wasn't on Twitter. So I was writing to nobody, really, which I think, with the benefit of hindsight, is why it worked. Mm. It worked because I was writing it was just from the heart. I just poured out. I think my first blog post was called "Other Mums Must Be Lying," which gives you an insight into my headspace at the time. But I wrote it, and then I kind of shared it with a few friends. I mean, it was getting kind of 10 hits on a post, and some of them came from me when I was rereading my own post. And then I sort of thought, I'm enjoying this. I'd written a few posts. I'm enjoying this. How can I get this out there? So Twitter was where I started. And I joined in with other people that were writing parenting blogs and kind of tagged onto what they were doing. And I don't know, I didn't really know, have a clue what I was doing, but just thought I would try and engage with people online to see if I could get some traffic my way. But it wasn't until it went onto Facebook that it really exploded. It didn't happen straight away. So it was a couple of, well, maybe 18 months after my first blog post, but a couple started to blow up on Facebook and my follower numbers just went berserk. I think there was 1 week where it went from like 20,000 followers to 70,000 followers on my Facebook page.
Wow. I mean, 20,000 is already quite a lot.
Yeah, exactly. And it had taken me nearly 2 years to get 1,000 followers on Twitter. So it wasn't like I was expecting. I think that was the thing right from the start. I never really had any expectation that anybody would want to read it, although I hoped that they might, but I didn't, you know, it was kind of starting from scratch. So who was I writing for? Myself, really, at that stage.
Mm. Although it's interesting to hear you say, even though it took a while, you were in a way consciously building your audience, weren't you? Because you were sort of going on social media and then trying to interact with the view of hopefully gaining some more followers. I mean, I'm sure you didn't expect it to be 70,000 suddenly, but you were consciously trying to build it, right? So you,
yes,
I find that interesting, because you were both sort of writing to yourself and I guess in some way thinking, actually, I'm enjoying this. I like the writing. I want to talk to people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the feeling that came back from having, because on a personal level, the kind of underlying the success of the Facebook page that was surprising, but also really exciting. Like I can remember sort of sitting at home in my pajamas and posting something and then watching kind of in real time the likes and the shares going up and thinking, oh my goodness, this is like big. I don't really understand it, but it seems to be everywhere. But also on a personal and more emotional level, I was getting messages coming back from people that were saying, you know, thanks for writing this, because this is how I feel as well. And I felt a little bit like maybe I was on my own or I was failing. Or so I guess I felt validated in everything I was saying as a new mum as well, which I think also inspired me to keep going. But yeah, you're right. As soon as I realized that I could, I don't know, it felt like kind of collecting an army. I'm not sure what we were preparing for, but there was just lots of us together. Well,
yes, and new motherhood, I mean, I've got two small children, as we were just talking about. New motherhood can be really lonely, particularly with my second, because my first I had a really good NCT group, actually, but my second, it can be really lonely. And funnily enough, I was just talking about this with someone yesterday, a friend who just had her third, and I was saying, how are you? And she goes, oh, you know, you can't complain, can you? And I was saying, I think you bloody can. It's really hard.
Yeah, it is hard.
And if you're not enjoying it, it's okay to say that. But some people really don't feel that it is okay to say that. So that's what you were sort of opening up, isn't it?
Yeah, it was exactly that. And I think you're right. The, you know, the age old kind of it takes a village saying. And I think, you know, in the modern world, quite often part of that village, at least, does come from the online space. So it felt like that's what I was tapping into at that time. But yeah, it was massively unexpected, the Facebook page momentum.
Yeah. And so then at some point you were approached by an agent, weren't you? And you ended up getting a book deal. Can you tell me a little bit about that, how that happened?
I can. It all
happened, and when?
Yeah. So it all happened at once. I was approached by my then editor and my agent the same week. So somebody from my now publisher, Transworld, got in contact with me on Facebook before my agent. So it was almost like the wrong way around. Like I'd bypassed the agent bit. Mm. But I had one message from an editor saying, we've been through all of your blog posts that you've written so far and really think the Unmumsy Mum blog lends itself to a book. What do you think? My first thought was that it was some kind of a hoax or, I just didn't believe it. You know, that is not how, in my mind, I suppose I thought, well, that's not how this works. It's all going the wrong way. And then an agent got in contact the same week saying, I think, you know, the blog has legs and we could perhaps pitch it to publishers, to which I replied, well, I've already got a publisher, but interested. How does this work? And actually, God love them, it was the publisher that said, even though this might not work in our favour, because we could just snap you up now unrepresented, you should have an agent. Because they will have your best interests at heart. They will make sure that you know, the contract works as hard as it can for you, and they'll protect you. So from somebody that had no idea about how publishing worked, I felt like I was given really good advice early on. That was because, you know, as far as I was aware, you would get an agent to get a publisher. But there was a bit of me that was thinking, well, I've got a publisher's just messaged, do I need an agent? But yes was the answer. You very much still do. And then I had a meeting and I remember thinking, they're gonna realize that they've made a mistake. They're gonna go, this isn't what we thought it was, or actually we've changed our mind. And I remember saying, I just don't understand, because I've got no background in writing. I haven't pitched anything to you, I haven't put together a proposal, I don't understand how we've got to where we've got to. And they said, well, we've printed like 30 of your blogs, we've put them all together, we've read them, we've taken them to our Tuesday morning acquisition meeting, and we've seen enough. You might not have realized that you've kind of put your CV out there online, but you sort of have. And that's where we are with it. But yeah, I found it all very, very, very strange and very exciting all at once.
Yeah, how amazing. And I think it's really interesting and pertinent to what we're about to talk about in a second, actually. But there's a feeling often that publishing is a world of gatekeepers and that you have to know someone and that sort of stuff. I think a lot of people feel that way. But actually what happened to you was really quite meritocratic. You weren't expecting it, but you did the work, you did writing, it was really good, and then people wanted to publish you.
Yeah. I think what had happened was, because I asked about this a couple of years after, and I sort of said, what was it like? You know, I can't imagine that it was just one, you know, what they'd seen one post and gone, well, let's take a gamble and write a blog. And I think what had happened was a couple of people had seen a single blog post, I can't remember which one it was, shared on their Facebook timelines of several of their Facebook friends at the same time, but had realized that the Facebook friends had each shared my post didn't know each other. So they felt like there was a movement, because it was like, well, he shared it and she shared it and she shared it, and they're all friends of mine, but none of them are friends with each other, which means they must have seen it somewhere else, which means, so I think in their mind they knew, or at least they hoped there would be an appetite for it, because online there was. So I suppose it ticked that box already.
Okay, so since then you brought out three non-fiction books with your sort of Unmumsy Mum hat on about motherhood. They're all very funny, they're all very honest. And I guess since then, you're now regarded as an influencer, which is relevant to what we're going to talk about in a second. But yeah, you know, you have sort of 419,000 followers on Instagram. I think you have about 700,000 on Facebook, something like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, you post a lot about your kids, your writing's still really funny, but I guess there's a feeling that because you're doing a lot of that writing in addition to your books on social media, that yes, you fall into this influencer category.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that? Because it is a term that is quite loaded, I guess.
It's massively loaded. And I actually have really mixed feelings about it, because on the one hand, I hate the term, because I think of all the connotations it has. And we think of, you know, kind of people constantly glued to their smartphones, you know, with every filter on, trying to sell unsuspecting people stuff with a tap to by link. So it kind of, we have this view of influencers, but then I also think it would be wrong of me to suggest that I am not one. Because, you know, if the shoe fits and the shoe does fit, I do post a whole range of stuff online. But just in terms of how the worlds collide, I did a post about Lisa Jules, the family upstairs. And I really enjoyed this book post, and it shot the book back up the Amazon chart when it had been out of the top 100 or whatever for some time. And Lisa actually very, very kindly sent me a proof of her new book with a note that said, "They don't call you influencers for nothing," which I think tells you kind of, that's how I feel, is that, you know, I am an influencer, because I have, you know, if you have a certain amount of followers and they trust and kind of enjoy what you share, then, you know, you do have influence. So yes. So I agree with that. I suppose where I find it difficult is where that influencer cap is seen as being kind of like my main identity in terms of work, which isn't how I feel, because, you know, I spend most of my time writing books, and actually book writing is the main source of my income. So I feel like I'm kind of author first and influencer second, but I don't know. I guess I'm both of those things. And I feel kind of sometimes horrified at the label. And then other times I feel quite defensive, because I'm like, well, you know, a lot of people that are online that have lots of followers have worked quite hard to get where they are. So, yeah.
Well, let's talk about your foray into fiction, because I think that plays a part here in the Twitter thread that we're going to talk about in a second. So yeah. Earlier this year, you brought out your debut novel, Stepping Up, which is really funny and moving. It's about a young woman who's quite sort of hapless and not very together, and something happens to her family, and she ends up kind of helping take care of her sister's kids, and it's quite a U-turn for her, and quite tricky. And anyone who likes your non-fiction writing will be unsurprised to see that to hear that it's quite a similar style of writing,
yeah,
in that it's quite jaunty and fun, but, you know, it is seamless fiction writing, and I really, really enjoyed Stepping Up.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. I mean, I really, you know, I think the thing is that whenever anybody, either an influencer or frankly anyone who's written non-fiction books, whenever anybody tries their hand at fiction where they haven't before, but they're already famous for something else, I think there's often a healthy dose of cynicism about whether it will be any good. Because, as you said, it's very hard to get a book deal as a debut author, but not so hard if you already have a platform.
Yeah.
So I think people are automatically going to say, oh, well, is this, you know, because somebody has a platform, or is it any good? Now, with Stepping Up, I would definitely say it is very good. But you, a few months ago, wrote a Twitter thread about how...
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
About how you were finding it difficult writing the second book, and about many other things. So if it's all right with you, I'm actually going to read out that Twitter thread, because I think in its entirety, it's really, really interesting. And then I just want to talk about that with you a wee bit.
Okay. Okay,
so it is quite long, listeners, but bear with us, because it's really, really interesting, I think. Okay, So in May, you wrote this. First draft anxiety is eating me whole at the moment. I rarely talk about how writing makes me feel, in part because I know I should be grateful with where life finds me, and I am. But there is also an anxiety associated with how I got here. I'm going to try to explain. The blog, nonfiction books, novels adventure I find myself on is beyond anything I would ever have dared to dream when I pressed publish on my first blog post in 2013. Writing for me at that time was a hobby. I had an unrelated part-time job and a very angry baby. A whirlwind followed. My posts were shared far and wide. My social media pages exploded and a book deal landed in my inbox. I quit my job to give writing a proper go. It wouldn't last. I was sure of that, but I was going to make book hay while the mum blog sun was shining. And that's when things got weird. Non-fiction book one became book two and then book three. They did well. I had this burning desire to try my hand at fiction, but for a long time couldn't even say that out loud. Who the hell did I think I was? Stay in your lane, Sarah, for God's sake. But I did say it out loud. I had the best team ever behind me who believed I could do it, so we went for it. I wrote a novel, and even though I thought many times that I'd bitten off more than I could chew, I kept chewing. The fourth draft was the one. It was published. And now I find myself writing the first draft of book number five, my second novel. And the imposter syndrome I feel is, in all honesty, crippling. I never share these thoughts because I fear doing so will prompt some very small violins. I am living the dream after all. But I rarely feel as though I deserve to be here. I read stuff every day about celebrity book deals and influencer book deals flooding the market. And with every piece I read, I feel a bit smaller. I feel guilty as though I've cheated the system. This isn't a praise fishing exercise. I am buoyed every day by my reviews and the lovely messages I receive, but I still feel it. The snobbery that exists, even if it's silent. The slight raise of the eyebrows when I talk at festivals about my journey to being published. When it hit the Sunday Times top 10, I was over the moon, but I don't think I truly believe I'd earned it. How could I? I celebrated with my whole heart, but later wondered if it was in fact a hollow victory. After all, my followers would buy it even if it was total tripe. I don't really know what the point of this thread is. It's extremely out of character. But I guess I just wanted to say that some people you follow who are living the dream still worry about their ability to do that dream justice. Many work really fucking hard because they feel they have more to prove. They don't want to churn out any old tripe and call it a bestseller. They want to deserve it. Okay, so
I was really on one that evening, I can tell.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I really remember reading that thread and following it through and finding it really interesting. And there's a lot to unpick. But yeah, tell me about what led, first of all, to you sharing all of that. Had you been feeling that way for a while?
Yeah, I think so. And I think there's a certain kind of unease and anxiety that comes with book writing anyway, when you're, you know, the highs and lows of the roller coaster of, you know, the euphoria of handing a draft in, but there's always a bit where you think you're never going to be able to hand it in because it's unpublishable rubbish and should never see the light of day. So that probably played a part, but there are always, I've had a suspicion for years, and this goes back to the nonfiction books as well, but that there is kind of a general feeling that influencers, I mean, I'm generalizing, but the influencers don't deserve the book deals that they're given because, you know, they're given a book deal for one reason and one reason only, and that's to tick a quick commercial exercise of, well, they've got lots of followers, a book will come out, it doesn't really matter how good it is, their followers will buy it, will ideally churn it out, you know, that mad October week just to get the Christmas market, and you know, everyone's a winner. And that has felt like something that for a while I thought perhaps I was imagining, but I don't think it is, because I've been to enough festivals and panel events and have seen enough threads that I'm not party to on Twitter to know that there is this feeling that, you know, there's a massive injustice that influencers cheat the system. And it's really tricky. The reason that it's so tricky is because I understand that I have felt for years as though I have cheated the system. So I suppose I don't always disagree with the threads that I read about books popping up from, you know, another influencer or another TV personality or whoever it might be. But I suppose it then prompts this defensiveness within me, because on the one hand, you have this massive leg up and this huge advantage because you have a platform and you have followers who really, you know, most of the time, I mean, not everybody that follows you really likes you, but you have people that are interested at least in what you have to say. So you do have a massive boost when it comes to book, when it comes to book sales. But at the same time, there are people who will never read anything that you've written purely because of your route into publishing. So there was a thread not so long ago on Twitter where a journalist had asked, out of interest for purposes of research, would you buy a book written by an influencer? And I think there were 72 replies that were almost unanimously, absolutely not. The replies were no, hell no, no, almost on principle, highly unlikely, it was, you know, that's kind of the response. And I suppose it's that sort of thing that for me makes me feel as though it doesn't matter how much effort I put in or how good something that I write could be, you know, there will be people that will, there'll be an eye roll and a, oh, but you just got given a book deal because you, you know, because you were popular on Facebook that time.
I suppose the thing is, though, is that, I mean, there are influencers and influencers, and you also happen to be a really good writer, which is why your posts took off. You know, you didn't, as you said before, you didn't just post pictures of your kids wearing all whites. And you didn't, you know, post videos of your children crying and just kind of, you know, share the despair of maternity leave either. You wrote things about it that were really funny. So, I mean, we don't, you know, there are others, you know, like you, I guess, and we don't say, oh, it's so unfair that Clover Stroud has another book out. She's really good at social media. You know, we just sort of say, oh, well, she's good at social media and she writes memoirs and, you know. You know, you could arguably say the same thing about people like Richard Osman. You go, oh, well, he's got a huge platform. Of course his books sell, but they also sell really well and people really love them. So I think there is a difference. I mean, of course, you know this, but it must feel very strange.
Yeah, I think it's that thing of, I don't know, maybe what comes first. So maybe sometimes it's important to consider how or why somebody became a blogger. Or, I mean, we say influencer now, but I guess I started, it was much more of an old school blog. You know, when I had the blog, that was before I had an Instagram page and Facebook and what have you. And it was really the blog posts that had led to, you know, so it was long form rather than a little Instagram caption here and there that had led to a book deal. So I do know that there's a difference, and I also do, I understand how publishing works, and I can see and appreciate and understand the frustration when you do sometimes feel like, you know, any book will be published if you can attach a celebrity or a influencer's name to it. So it's not as though I don't understand why there might be a frustration, or at least people are hesitant to, but I think that kind of blanket snobbery of, well, you know, blogger turned author. I mean, I felt it not often, but I've done the odd kind of book festival, and generally the book festivals themselves are really super lovely, and as are you know, everybody in publishing. But where I've done events with other authors, you can see the immediate moment when you have a conversation with somebody and they say, you know, how did you get into writing or what have you, and you say, oh, I had a blog and it took off, and there's that moment where you feel like you're almost at that point excluded from the conversation with the other panelists because you didn't go the proper route, you didn't graft to get there in the way that they did. And having gone from thinking maybe I've imagined that, I've kind of gone back over conversations and things I've had over the years, and I'm like, no, it was almost certainly there. That kind of, I can remember somebody saying something along the lines of, you know, you're so lucky to have been handed a book deal dream on a plate without having to kind of knock on any doors and et cetera, et cetera. And I think I can appreciate that there is a great amount of fortune at play there, that the right people saw my blog posts at the right time. So yes, you know, luck does always play a part, but I don't think I was handed them for no reason. I think I was handed a book deal because they thought that it would make a good book, because they liked my writing, which is I guess the most important thing. So yeah, it's a really tricky one to try and explain. But
you wrote, "But I rarely feel as though I deserve to be here." Who do you think does deserve to be here?
I don't know. And I also think that in any walk of life, you know, imposter syndrome is rife. And I'm sure that somebody who had gone the traditional route and had suffered kind of multiple rejections and had really kind of been banging on doors for years would still feel at times as though they don't deserve to be here. I mean, I follow or engage with so many authors online that could be writing their 15th book and they'll reach a point where they go, well, I can't do this, I'm clearly rubbish at this, it's not the job for me, despite the fact that they've written 14 previous bestsellers. So I know it's human sort of nature as well. But I think there's just the odd thing that sometimes I see or hear that I think it's a really hard, it's that kind of, well, you didn't really, you've only got a book deal because you've got all of these followers. And I do, there's part of me that knows that the original book deal came because, you know, at least in part because I generated such a strong following. So I don't always disagree with the rationale behind it, but that blanket, no, I would never consider writing a book that was written by an influencer, I just find it a little bit insulting, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's silly to cut out any large group of writers, really, isn't it? I mean, how do you know what they're going to be like until you've read them? Everyone's different.
Exactly, yeah.
So you had these fears and other forms of self-doubt when you were writing book two, which is why you wrote The Thread. And did you also have them when you were writing book one? Sorry, I say book one and book two. I, of course, actually mean book four and book five. But in terms of fiction,
I know what you mean.
Book one and two.
Yeah, I did, I think.
And how did you deal with them when you were drafting?
I think I'm really lucky to have such a nice, supportive network around me. So, you know, the editing team and my agent and also my family that kind of will give me that nudge to say, you know, no, you know, you deserve to be here, which is why you are here, keep going. And usually that's all I need. And I think that's why that Twitter thread was so out of character, because I would rarely, even if I have those feelings, I would rarely kind of vocalize them, especially not online, because again, I then think people will think, oh, you know, what's she moaning about now? She's got, you know, she's living the dream and she's still finding something to moan about. But I think, I don't know, I find that I can switch. I think it's probably like anyone. I can switch from being like, I'm really concentrating and I've got my head in the game, and actually for me a big boost came, I think, when it went out for kind of early review and I started to get all the NetGalley reviews in, and they were really good. I mean, they're never all good, are they, but they were, you know, overwhelmingly really good reviews, and they were from people that said, you know, I've never read anything by this author before, not a parent or what have you, but really enjoyed this, and I started to relax a bit. I think I started to think maybe it's going to be all right. But yeah, even some of the Amazon reviews are interesting. I should have printed one off so that I could read it out to you. But there was one that said something along the lines of, I assumed this was just going to be another influencer given a book deal because it would sell copies regardless of how good they are. However, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was touching and moving and. But I just sort of thought that's the starting point for that person, is that they've picked it up. I think they picked it up in the supermarket, it was on special, and their baseline like expectation was it will probably be rubbish because they're somebody that's got followers, but I'll give it a go anyway. And I was really pleasantly surprised. It was a good
yes test. The ultimate balm to your fears.
You know those sort of comments, I was expecting x, but are kind of peppered within the Amazon reviews, which is really interesting. But yeah, I suppose that's what keeps me going. I do have a faith and belief in my ability as a writer, I think, even though at times I find it hard, or there are things that I see or hear that make me doubt myself. But I think overwhelmingly, I wouldn't be, if I didn't think that I could do it or that I did deserve to be here, then day to day, I don't think I would put myself through it. I think I would just go back to a normal, in inverted commas, job, which I would be happy to do if the writing train ever stops for me. But fingers crossed it doesn't.
I don't think you need to do that just yet.
We're all right for now.
You're all right for now. Before you started chatting with your team about having a go at some fiction, had you been doing any fiction? Had you been sort of doing any creative writing at home? Had you been sort of giving that a go already? Or
yeah, so I had sent them the first maybe 30,000 words of a novel that I'd started that was, in all honesty, the fiction version of my non-fiction. It was basically the Unmumsy Mum, but novel form.
Okay. Yeah.
Slightly struggling mum at the school gates. And I realized I enjoyed writing it. I enjoyed the ability to kind of play with comedy in that way. And I had sent it to Transworld between, I think, non-fiction books 2 and 3, and they had gone, "We really like this. We think this is great. Happy for you to pursue this." But it actually wasn't the novel that I wanted to write. I didn't want to write exactly the same thing. I felt like I wanted something that had a little bit more heart and a little bit more like the books that I like to read. So I sort of said, "I'm glad that you liked it, but I don't think this is going to be the one for me. And this is the nonfiction book 3 idea I've had, and I'd be happier if we could just do that. And then I will put more thought to what I want my first novel to be, rather than just writing." I knew I could write that book, but it wasn't the book that I wanted to write. In all honesty, the stuff my kids do in real life is funnier than the fiction version of my non-fiction that I'd had a bash at. But I guess they had seen hopefully enough at that point to think she can do it. It's, you know, different style, but
yeah. I think that's so funny. I mean, your posts about your children are very funny. Little Wilf.
Oh Wilf.
But that's so interesting. And I suppose if you had brought out a novel like that, that fear you had about people assuming that you were just sort of converting, you know, that part of your life into fiction would have, you know, been compounded, because even if the book had been really good, it would have felt like much more of a follow-on from your social media, I guess.
Yeah.
Whereas stepping up is really quite different.
Yes. Yeah. And I do get people, despite the kind of splash, you know, the splashes on the front or the cover or what have you, I have had people message me who have read Stepping Up, who've picked it up in the bookshop or haven't put 2 and 2 together, they haven't properly looked at it, they've just sort of picked it up and read it and then gone, "It's taken me until I've read the author bio to realise that I've read your non-fiction books," which is quite nice. So it's like, it does feel like the next step, the fiction adventure, that is different. But like you say, with still the same tone and familiarity to people that have enjoyed my nonfiction, hopefully. So I'm really proud of those nonfiction books. So it's not that I wanted to draw a line under them and never speak of them again. Like the Unmumsy Mum adventure is still kind of ongoing with those books, and it's nice to see them pop up in different countries and different translations and things. But yes, the Stepping Up, I felt like I wanted it to be different enough so that it was a bit of a statement in terms of this is the next chapter.
Yeah. No, I hope you never stop the Unmumsy Mum stuff. I want to see some like the Un-Granny or something. I mean, that feeling of being an imposter in your own life, I think, is unlikely ever to go away, whichever stage
exactly.
You're at.
Not
you personally, Sarah, but all of us who feel that way.
Yeah, you're right. And then, let's be honest, you feel like that as a parent as well. You know, the number of times I've taken one of my 3 kids to a birthday party or a toddler group or something, and just had that really weird out of body experience when I think, how am I qualified or trusted to be responsible in this situation? It's nothing short of preposterous that somebody's given me a license to have these children and look after them. So I suppose it's just a, you know, book writing is no different. You always, it can be the thing that you want to do most in the world, and you can still feel as though you need to prove you're worthy of of continuing to do it. I think that's just, I don't think that'll ever leave me. And maybe yeah. it's for the best that it doesn't, you know. If I was sat here going, well, I really deserve my place, I think I'm brilliant, then
yes,
you know, yeah. that would be perhaps problematic as well. So there's a balance.
So when you wrote Stepping Up, I mean, you mentioned in the thread that draft four was the one.
Yes.
How did you feel, I mean, not moment to moment, but, you know, when you were sort of in the thick of things in the writing, was yeah. that tough? Did you find it hard moving from draft to draft? Because you knew that your editors were, you know, keen, which is obviously a massive advantage. But yeah. nonetheless, you still have to draft and redraft. And that's presumably quite different from nonfiction, in which yeah. you also draft, but in a different way. So tell me a little bit about that. How did that feel for you at the time?
It is an entirely different ballgame, fiction. And that's not to say that nonfiction is easy, but the process is easier to kind of compartmentalize your book writing around other things in your life when you're writing nonfiction, in that I could write a chapter and the blog posts themselves sort of lent themselves to chapters, and I could write a chapter, for example, for the Unmumsy Mum A to Z. You know, I would be shopping in IKEA and I would suddenly think, oh, I is for IKEA. That would be good. Or we ended up in A&E with a head injury for one of the kids. And I thought, oh, A is for A&E. And you can almost jot down a phone note, start writing it, add it to the pile. And like a giant game of Jenga, if I handed in, you know, a draft of nonfiction and one of the chapters wasn't working, you could remove a chapter and the whole tower wouldn't fall down. Fiction, it's not quite like that, because there's so many strands, you know, to a novel that are interwoven, and so many considerations that I found it much more consuming for my thought process. So it wasn't something that I could just log on for a couple of hours in the evening. It was, if I was in it, I was in it, and I was struggling to think about anything else. So yeah, the drafts of the novel were intense. It was a very steep learning curve. I mean, my editor insists that my first draft wasn't terrible, but I'm telling you now, it was terrible. It was really bad. And I love their diplomatic. I love editors so much, so much. Like how diplomatic they are with the language that they use around what needs doing. So for example, my editor, I love her too much, will say things like, just don't feel like this chapter earns its place in the narrative. Or yeah. she'll say, I'm not sure that this character is working as hard as he can be for you. Or and it's just brilliant. It's great. It's poetry in itself, the editorial feedback letters.
Yes. There's a lot of distance there.
Oh,
that character's not doing their job. It's nothing to do with you. They're just they're not
exactly.
pulling their weight.
Yeah, exactly. It does. You do. It's yeah. It's passive. It's like that pesky character. So there are a few moments where I did feel very out of my depth, and I did think I thought to myself, of all the things I've taken on and manage to do, I've always had that thing of, you're only, you know, deal with 1 hour at a time, whatever life throws at you, you'll probably be, a lesson will be learned here, you'll be able to make it, and one day you'll look back on this and laugh. It's kind of served me well thus far, but I did have moments with the writing first draft, especially with Stepping Up, where I thought, you this is the one that's going to defeat you. You can't, what are you doing? Why do you think that you can just write a novel now? And then I would have moments where I would think, this is awful. This is the worst thing that's ever been written. But I would come back to it, step away, come back to it, read a little bit of dialogue that I'd written between two characters, and do that really cringy thing where I would make myself laugh, where there would be like a little bit of dialogue. And I would think to myself, oh, it's quite funny, this. I mean, the other 90,000 words is terrible, but there's a glimmer, there's a glimmer here of something. And just know that every author that I've ever spoken to has said, there's a reason why only like your editor sees the first draft.
Yes.
It doesn't, you know, so just keep going. But yeah, I loved it. I love the feedback, because even if the feedback is there's a lot to do, I just know that every bullet point will make my work better. So it's like it still feels like such a privilege to be edited, and I do really enjoy it. I find the first draft stage the bit where I have to really dig deep. to get it over the line, and then I can relax because I think whatever happens next is only going to get better.
Do you actually, when you say first draft that you send to your editor, I mean, is that literally the first draft, or do you have an earlier sort of messier kind of, you know, jumble of words that nobody sees?
No, it is really, it is pretty much that first draft, and it's still quite patchy. Everything, the bare bones of it are there, but it's kind of without any of the sparkle, I think, that I didn't realize tends to come tends to come later.
Yeah.
I mean, it might not for everyone, and there are little bits where I'm really, that I'm happy with from the first draft, but there are also quite a few kind of to be confirmed bits, not whole chunks, but there are a couple of bits where I wasn't sure whether to go with, you know, X route or Y route in terms of what happens with a plot strand at that point. So I actually have actually just left it and put TBC, because I think I, you know, get to a point where you feel as though you need some feedback. So I've just handed in the first draft of novel 2, and nobody's seen or read any of it, and I've reached the point where I need somebody on my team to kind of say this is working or this isn't working, or so I feel like I'm ready to be a sponge for feedback.
I don't think I could show my actual first draft to anyone, honestly, because mine are so messy that they have things like, I mean, really quite often things like, you know, like in parentheses, make interesting here, or like,
yeah,
you know, or like, I remember with my book that didn't sell, I remember going through the first draft and then messaging my writer friend saying, I've written a lot about something called phone mail, which I don't even know what it is, as a, you know, somewhere between phone calls and emails, like, I yeah. don't even, or voicemail, I mean, I don't know. But apparently that had come up a lot in the book and I didn't even know what it was. So the thought of somebody reading that, which is very, very
yeah, there is a point during the writing process where, so I tend to use Scrivener to write the first draft rather than Word, so that I can kind of portion out the chapters and add a little note about the characters and stuff on the side. And there are, before it gets to the point where I hand it in, I do kind of self-edit it, and I was yeah. just about to send it over. There are a couple where I've simply written in the notes in bold and capitals, what is the point of this chapter, Sarah? And I was probably, because in my head I've learned from last time and I've got my editor in my head, and I'm thinking it's not earning its place. It needs yes. to earn its place.
Yes.
So yeah, and or like you've said about, you know, this but make interesting. I've got a couple where I've just put, this needs to be funnier, or make this person more interesting, or yeah. So but that will never, that's kind of as I go. And then when I get to the, when I've really kind of gone, right, got to the end, I tidy that up and send it over and hope for the best.
Yeah. Well, good luck. I hope you get some good feedback soon. I know you've mentioned your mum a few times in your writing,
yeah.
Who, for people who haven't followed you for a long time, like, died when you were a teenager.
Yeah.
And of course, Stepping Up is about families being disrupted by grief.
Yes.
So I'm presuming that played on your mind a wee bit when you came up with that concept. I wonder what you think your mum would say now if you could tell her both about all your success and also about, you know, this self-doubt that you retain.
Yeah, I think my mum would be, I mean, I hope she would be proud of the kind of book writing adventure that I've been on. I think I thought of her a lot when I was writing Stepping Up, and actually I had, you know, I've mentioned my mum in my nonfiction work before, so it wasn't a new thing. I've written about her, but I suppose Stepping Up was more, you know, grief was at the forefront of my mind when I was writing it. And there's a teenage character, Polly, in the book, who's a similar age to I was when my mum died. So I guess it kind of, it took me back to teenage grief and what it's like to be a teenager and lose someone, which, as I was having a conversation with somebody the other day who messaged me to say that their husband had died and they had a teenager, and she was talking about Stepping Up in that context and saying that the surprising thing about teenagers is how they can be completely consumed by grief, but at the same time really concerned about what they're going to wear to a party on Saturday night because they're a teenager. And I really relate to that, which is how I think I felt confident writing Polly. But yeah, I think my mum was quite matter of fact and quite no nonsense when it came to advice, at least in my teenage years. So I can sort of imagine saying me going off on one and writing one of these dramatic Twitter threads. And I can almost imagine my mum being like, oh, don't be so self-indulgent. just, you know, give yourself a slap round the face with a wet fish and get on with it, I think. I don't think she would have. I don't know. I feel like it's hard to know because I haven't had a relationship, you know, I haven't had a relationship with her as an adult. So I don't know, but I can, from memory, you know, I don't think she'd have had much time for me maudling about anything. I feel like she would have been like, just crack on with it, for God's sake. And so that does, you know, that does play on my mind as well. And also it's really interesting, like, that you say that you found that thread interesting on Twitter, and I had a few people that messaged as well, and or who have referenced it, like it's kind of stuck in their mind as being, well, that's what you really think about like life as an author / influencer. And it's really interesting because it's one of the only things I've ever posted online that I've almost had like an overexposure hangover for posting afterwards, if that makes sense, where you sort of, I woke up the next day and thought, I've overshared, and I, you know, overshare for a living, but it was like, I've overshared, that it's almost like it's too, I've put too much out there. That's like the bit of your brain that you don't share, the secret, you know, I'm wondering if I deserve to be here. And there was a really big part of me that was quite tempted just to delete it and pretend that I'd never spoken it out loud. But I'm glad I didn't. But
I'm glad you didn't, because I mean,
interesting one.
Self-indulgence about self-doubt is literally the point of this podcast. So I'm very glad that you didn't.
Thank you so much for listening to Write Off. Do come find me to chat on Twitter, where I'm at Francesca Steele, and Instagram, where I'm at Francesca.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Steele writes, I'll put that in the show notes.
If you enjoyed Write Off, please do share it with others, and please, please, please consider leaving a review on the iTunes app, which really helps other people find the podcast. Thanks, and see you next time.